News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on News Talk 580 KMJ. You're hearing us in the evenings at 5 o'clock on the FM KMJ 105.9 now, and you can find it anytime at kmjnow.com. Each week we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories for the future, and along the way be inspired, learn a little thing or two about what it means to love our country. And if you hear a little hustle and bustle behind us today, it's because we're doing this interview at Woodlake Hardware, where our guest, Morris Bennett, has spent most of his life. That's really safe to say. In fact, you graduated from Woodlake High School in 1940, and the next day you went to work at Woodlake Hardware?
The next day I went to work here as a repairman for washing machines and refrigerators.
Wow, and more than 70 years later, here he is in his office at Woodlake Hardware. We'll get more of that story, but I want to ask you what you remember about December 7th, 1941. I'm guessing you were in Woodlake when you heard about the attacks on Pearl Harbor.
No, I was up at Snelling with my grandfather and an uncle. We was duck hunting. And we came into the little town of Snelling at the general store and to have a cup of coffee and refreshments. And it was on the little local radio that they had there that they said Pearl Harbor was bombed. And that was about 10 o'clock in the morning, if I recall correctly. And that was on December the 7th, 1941.
I think that general store is still there in Snelling, right by the old town Frosty over there.
I don't know. I haven't been Snelling for a long time, so I don't know.
I was there not too long ago. Well, what did that mean to you as a young man? I mean, at that point, you're what, 19 years old? You're about to celebrate your, well, you're about to celebrate your 19th birthday 2 days later. How did that rock your world to hear that news?
Well, I knew that I'd be drafted because almost everybody of my age was already had joined the service, or if they were in the physically, as I was, that we would be drafted. So far, I decided to take the test to be a cadet, because in other words, I'd rather fly than I would, although I'd never flown an airplane, but in other words, I had a friend that had two brothers had a World War I Jenny tied up in a tree at home, and we used to play in that, so. And that's the closest I ever came to an airplane outside of building model airplanes and things like that.
But you had quite the mechanical background from fixing all kinds of farm equipment and different things. So you decided to enlist in the Army Air Corps. But if you were going to fly anything, you'd have to pass a test. And did you have any idea what was going to be on that test?
No, I had no idea what it could be, but I did pass it good enough. But they had too many young fellows waiting to be cadets at the time, so they told me to come home and they'd notify me in a few days. I got a letter about 10 days, 2 weeks later from President Roosevelt, and said they are having a new glider program and that I was qualified to be a glider pilot, and report to Sequoia Field for my physical. If I passed that, in other words, I was on my way.
So when you get a letter, it says you're qualified to be a glider pilot. Did that make you scratch your head a little bit? Say, what in the world is a glider going to do for a war?
Well, I had no idea what it would be, but in other words, they said you'd report to Salinas Army Air Base if you passed the Sequoia Field, and you'd be on your way. So in other words, I went to Salinas, and I was sworn in at Monterey in the U.S. Army. This was in June of 1942, and I'd never been to San Francisco from the San Joaquin Valley. In other words, I didn't even have a jacket, so the bridge was no such thing as the Bay Bridge now. We had to go across on a ferry. It was cold, so I finally got down out of the wind a little bit and got over there and we waited. That was cold, and all I had was just to dress up at that time. The big deal would be a white shirt and a pair of Levi's.
And I'm sure the eye-opening was just beginning, because San Francisco feels a world away, but you would literally be a continent away before you were done. So how do you train to be a glider pilot? Do you fly single-engine planes?
Most of the people from the West Coast was sent to Randolph Field. The people from the East Coast were sent to Victorville, California. And Victorville was the first base that they trained glider pilots. And there at Victorville, in other words, they started them out in the sailplanes. But in our case, which I had never flown at it, we had to, and even the people that had flown, had taken civilian pilot training in college, had to go to what they call primary training. And you had to solo in 6 to 7 hours, and then you had night flying, cross-country flying, dead stick flying, and we got, I had approximately 60 hours in my primary deal, which a big portion of them, I only got maybe 30 hours in primary. Training was in taking in Cubs and Ironicas and Taylor craft, which was light aircraft. And the dead stick, what they do, the instructor would go up with it and he'd cut the deal, and then you had to land at a certain spot and be able to do that.
Now, you had never flown before, so is this something that came naturally to you? Did you feel it click at some point?
It was a natural deal. Of course, we had to take on the ground. In other words, we went to college. Just on the May, we had aircraft identification, Morse code, the same thing as the cadets did. We even took link trainer training, which was what they call under the hood in this type of deal. They would use these auxiliary fields to land in. So near that, then if you was lucky to get a plane, the student pilot could take more training and shoot what we call shoot landings. If he let you shoot landings, or maybe go up and do some aerial maneuvers, figure eights and so forth, whatever the case was, without an instructor. You by yourself, you're just a student. He told me how long to do it. And on the Ironica, I was flying on the Ironica, and the gas gauge was a little piece of plastic up by the window. And I looked at it, and it looked like I had plenty of gas in it. And so I flew another 5 or 10 minutes, made 2 or 3 more landings, and I started back to base. On the way, I got about the same feel that I had an emergency that my instructor gave me the emergency landing in early, but I was going a different direction this time than I was before. So I landed as an alfalfa field. So I landed perfectly and went over to the farmhouse and called the base and told them I was had emergency landing. And so about 15 minutes, there came a real fancy airplane with my instructor and the captain of the Army Air Force at Hayes, Kansas, which was in charge of the pilot training, and they had a 5-gallon can of gas with them, and they poured it into it, and they pulled it through, and my instructor got in it and flew it off, and he went back to the base, and I flew back with the captain from the Air Force. We got back to the base, and they called me in, and I thought I could be washed out. I mean, things like this is what wash you out. And so they had the interview, and 20 minutes later, of course, I hadn't been in the Army long enough to really get up and stand attention what I did, and so they called me on that when I first went in, because I wasn't snapped too, but I learned from that there to pay attention to Army officers. So anyway, they checked me out and said, well, that is what we're training you to do, exactly what you did, and it was a perfect landing, and everything was done just right, so I went right on through, and then right after that, we started our night flying and dead stick landing at night even.
What's the secret to that? Because I'd be nervous trying to land a plane with power, let alone a dead stick, and I'd be scared to death with a dead stick landing, let alone at night. So what helped you have the confidence to do that, and what did you find was the secret to making that work?
I don't know. Really, it was just came naturally. In other words, you kind of flew by all the gliders I flew. You kind of flew by the seat of your pants. In other words, it's like driving down 99 at 80 miles an hour, and here's some guy passing you at 90 miles an hour, and you stay in the right lane and watch him go on by or something. In other words, and you that's kind of what it would be. But the glider is itself, without no power, is like being sitting in somebody towing you or a broke down car, and you were in the car that they were being towed. That's kind of how you feel. So you're kind of on your toes all the time of being able to do things.
A lot of people listening might not even know that gliders were used in World War II. People who know about June 6th that maybe have heard about the role gliders played that day. But why do I get the idea that you never actually got to fly a glider until you had to do it for real?
How the program came about, the Germans had, in Belgium, they were called a Siegfried Lion, if I recall correctly. I mean, I'm going back 80 years, 70 years now, so it's a long time since my history. But they was able to cut some gliders loose, fly them in, were towed by bombers at probably 5,000 feet elevation. And they landed beyond the Siegfried lines, and in an hour's time, they had captured all of the forts and all these things that they figured was that nobody would be able to get to them with land forces. And that's why come that our government decided we need gliders the same as the Germans did.
So basically, and I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that you, as one of the first glider pilots, you're really kind of a guinea pig, weren't you?
That is right. First ones and one of the youngest ones also. A good portion of the glider pilots, most of them were 10 or 15 years older than I was. They had been flying for several years, but they still had to go through the same program that I had to go through, in other words, even if they'd been flying for a long time. From Greenville, South Carolina, we went back to Stuttgart, Arkansas. And Stuttgart, Arkansas, that was where they were using advanced combat gliders. That's where the CG-4, which was an American glider, and a CG-4 would hold 13 troopers, a pilot and a co-pilot, or a jeep, or a trailer, or a small bulldozer, or a howitzer, 75-millimeter howitzer. Or you could take just ammunition, or you could take guns, or you take whatever, food, or whatever the case would be.
And I can just picture some of our listeners who aren't familiar with this little chapter in World War II history saying, you could put all that heavy kind of stuff in a glider, really? And the answer, of course, is yes, you can. We've got some good links on the Hometown Heroes page at kmjnow.com if you want to supplement the firsthand education you're getting from Morris Bennett today. But you almost never got to fly gliders in combat because the program almost went to the junk heap, right?
During this time, they had the first invasion from Africa was at Sicily. The program almost broke up right then, the whole thing, because the Navy shot down some of the tow ships because they didn't know where they were. They came in at night, and when the boys took off the gliders took off in Africa, there was lots of dust. And so some of them even got unorientated, and they didn't get to Sicily. When they got to Sicily, they were scattered all over the whole island, the same as what the paratroopers were that dropped in ahead of them. And they were the whole island, where you're supposed to be, they'd know was there. And a lot of the gliders were shot down at sea, or because the tow ships were down, they didn't make Sicily. That was the beginning of the deal, so they almost threw the program out. So then they decided then that they would reevaluate, and they washed out some of the pilots, transferred some of them to the Army.
Yeah, they would end up using them as artillery spotters and things like that. I've read that 200 men drowned at sea because of the glider problems in that Sicily invasion, so clearly they needed to find a way to make it work. They needed better planning, better intelligence, better organization. And if you've ever been to Lubbock, Texas and visited the Silent Wings Museum, I've got it linked on our website if you haven't, and that's where a lot of this was accomplished before the Allied invasion of Normandy.
Lubbock, Texas was going to be the main training base for combat gliders. We got to Lubbock, and they said, well, we got too many here to train at the same time, so everybody's going to have to go through engineering school at Wichita Falls, Texas. And that is how to put the gliders together, how to manufacture them, repair them.
And for people that aren't familiar with it, what are these gliders made out of?
They're made out of tubing and plywood and plexiglass, and covered with fabric, which was dope that they used to use in making model airplanes. In other words, the same idea, what they call dope on the fabric, and that would reinforce them. So we had to graduate from there, and then we went back to Lubbock, and we took our advanced training there. And that was the fall of 43, and I graduated from Lubbock in December of 43.
So we're still a little more than 6 months away from D-Day here, and you would spend some of that time undergoing ground warfare training like an infantryman or artilleryman would. They had you ferrying gliders from base to base around the country, and then one day they tell you, you've got to go to Fort Bragg, North Carolina for some special training. I'm sure you had no idea how significant this was going to become. Tell me what you remember about that.
We went on down to Fort Bragg and was there about 10 days, took special training. We weren't told what our mission was going to be, but we knew we were going to go to Europe. And we got to Fort Wayne, Indiana. We was given all our shots, and I issued special ammunition, special guns, special revolvers, and special watches. And we sat there for about a week. In the meantime, what had happened, in Europe, the weather had changed, so they had to change the invasion date for Normandy. I know we were slated to be dropped way behind the lines, this fellows that was doing this type of work for reconnaissance or take some special deal. They never did tell us what it was, but with the equipment we had and the shots we had, we knew we was going to be on something special. But anyway, they called that mission off, sent us to Boston, and we went, instead of flying us over where we were supposed to go, or the roads, we went across on a troop ship, which was took 3 or 4 days, and I joined the 439th Group and the 94th Squadron of Troop Carrier, which had been in England about 6 or 7 weeks, something like that. We knew that the invasion was coming very shortly, so we had to carry full packs and run for every day. And so we got there, and they didn't have enough American gliders, so I had to fly a English glider, a Horsa glider, and in the Normandy. And I went on June 6th, so there was just a breaking day. Probably we was on double daylight saving. It was probably 4 o'clock in the morning. We took off from our base, and I had just had paratroopers is what we had instead of glider fighters, which normally glider infantry is what we normally would carry, but they had put paratroopers in these gliders, and they didn't like, they'd rather jump than ride a glider.
All right, I'm going to stop you right there because we need to take a break, but this is really striking. On one of the most monumental days in human history, we know now, you weren't exactly set up to succeed there. A powerless plane you'd never flown before with paratroopers who were not happy to be on a glider, and oh, by the way, there were Germans down there, and you'd be landing behind enemy lines. Holy cow. We'll find out how it all worked out for Woodlake's Morris Bennett when Hometown Heroes continues after a word from our sponsors, like Fresno Distributing.
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno T.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today is a 1940 graduate of Woodlake High School in Tulare County, home of the Tigers, of course. He started working at Woodlake Hardware the day after he graduated, and he's owned the place now for decades. But there's one day of Morris Bennett's life that is pretty unforgettable. June 6th, 1944. Let's pick up where we left off now. Instead of the American CG-4 glider you'd trained on, you were flying a British Horsa glider. Take us back there.
The Horsa, a British glider, will hold 30 people, plus a pilot and a co-pilot. And we had gas masks. So we didn't know what we would have. So we were one of the few gliders that landed intact in Normandy. And we landed, like I say, it was just breaking day. The pro ships had already been in and flown paratroopers in and dropped them about 4 hours before we went. And they came back to England, refueled, tied up on the gliders, and when they would take us off, we were Cliff Mueller, which passed away a few years ago. He was and I flew together, and we were in the air. Cliff was on the in the first pilot seat, and I was on the other one, and we couldn't get the nose wheel up. The tow ship was already in the air. Normally, the tow ship is still on the ground, and we were in the air, but you could see the exhaust because this was daylight, dark. You could see the blue coming out of the exhaust, and we were still on the ground. We were about ready to cut off and land in the ocean, and we went ahead and made the deal. We were back about, I think we was 45 or 40, usually 550 gliders in a stick, what we call a group. Each group would have a deal, and takes about 45 minutes to make the group together to come back in a formation. And they're four abreast, just staggered four across.
Well, and it seems to me, and again, a lot of people might have no knowledge of gliders at all, So they probably want to know, what were the tow ships? How did you guys get airborne? What?
Normally on the Horsa glider, they were towed by the British four-engine Fairfax bombers. But our C-47s or DC-3s, which are, some people call them one thing, some people call them something else, they were able to tow a Horsa glider or two CG-4 gliders on twin tow, which we flew later on, but not on Normandy, which was just a single tow on, or even on the CG-4s.
Where are the ropes tied onto your glider?
Not on ropes, and I don't remember what they are. In other words, I got it in 330 feet or 350 foot, about 5/8, 7/8 nylon rope.
Kind of like the stuff you sell here at Woodlake Hardware, huh? You can get it by the foot.
We don't sell it as big as what we had then. Like on takeoff, when we couldn't dare hear about, 10 years ago, Cliff came by and visited me one day, and he says, "I guess you know you saved my life." And I said, "Why is that?" He says, "Don't you recall telling those paratroopers to some of them get back in the plane a little bit so we get the nose wheel off?" And I said, "No, I don't remember." And he says, "Well, I sure as hell did."
You had to rebalance the plane, huh?
Yeah, balance it up to get, that's how come we was able to go ahead and get off. Otherwise, we would...
You never would have gotten off the ground.
In other words, we would end in the ocean. And with these 30 guys behind us, that's much weight in this thing. And we weren't that really good Horsa pilots because we hadn't flown that, in a Horsa that much. The CG-4, in other words, I could have done a lot more with it, but they were not with that thing.
You spent over a year training to fly one kind of glider, then on the biggest day of your life, you end up in a glider you've never flown before, and you're going to end up in the English Channel, and you're all going to sink in the ocean if you didn't make that adjustment, huh? Where do you think that came from? What clicked in your mind to ask them to do that?
I don't know. It just wasn't coming off. I said, we got to get some weight in the back end up to get the nose up. I don't know. It's just one of them things that you do.
What was your mission, and how did it unfold?
Normandy, in other words, we landed, like I say, about daylight. We got to the CP, it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, which was a command post where the 101st troopers, paratroopers, and with St. Mary Galice is where the town was that we landed, and that's where the CP was in an apple orchard. We soon we got there, in other words, I told the glider pilots, in other words, you head back for the beach. Your mission is done for this deal. Go back to the beach and you fly another mission. So we started back, walking back. Some people rode a bicycle or most of it walking. There was about 15 of us got a Jeep that had been wrecked earlier. We got on it and got back to the beachhead. And the tanks were coming in by this time. It was probably 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. One of the tank commanders says, "Get that pile of junk out of the road." And we just drove off the side of the road and off the sand dune and walked on the rest of the way in. And then they said, "Well, these guys have all lost their guns and everything coming in. So stack your guns and ammunition over there. And these other fellows have lost theirs on the landing. They've got something to work with." And they said, "Get on this landing craft and go out to this British cruiser that has shot its guns out on the earlier landing, earlier that morning. They're going back to Britain." So by 9 o'clock, I was on this cruiser, and the next morning I was back in England. And I got a 3-day pass because, in other words, that everything worked all right, and I didn't have to go back on another mission on that one.
But I'm sure there's a lot more to that day than what you just shared with us. You take off from England, and you are going over the English Channel, being towed by these bigger planes. What did you see? Did you see a bunch of other gliders? Did you see bombers everywhere? Did you see ships down below? Paint a picture for us.
Thousands of all types of battleships. The Navy was, there was the landing. In other words, we could see the firing. In other words, ahead of us where we were headed. And as the tow ships went in earlier, as I was said, earlier, in other words, they dropped the paratroopers, and then so when the tow pilots got close to where the anti-aircraft fire was coming up to us, in other words, they already had turned, and they'd be going straight ahead on us, but they'd already turned, and they was off to our left. It was almost quarter degrees from where they should have been, and so we kept going as far as we could till we cut loose, and we seen a field that we could land in that didn't have the telephone poles, what they call the Rommel's asparagus, and the hedgerows is what got most of us. We had no idea that they briefed us on the hedgerows, but they didn't tell us that the hedgerows are full of rocks, which was maybe 10, 15, 20 foot wide and 10 or 15 foot high. And that's what most of the gliders run into. In other words, that landed, the crash stop was hitting the trees and the hedgerows.
So I'm going to ask you some dumb questions here, just because this is not something most of us are familiar with. When you say you cut loose, how do you do that? How do you get the glider loose from the tow?
You just hit a lever, and it drops the ring out of the tow ship, out of the glider, and that's it. And the tow ship can cut you loose, too, because they could do the same thing. They could do the same thing. They're supposed to have somebody watching the glider all the time, but sometimes they didn't do it.
So on this one, June 6th, you pull that lever. You're on your own. You've got 30 paratroopers in your plane with you and a co-pilot. You're responsible for all these lives. You're on the most intense day of battle in world history, basically, is what you're facing here. You get a little adrenaline rush there. What was going through your mind as you cut loose and realized, here we go?
You don't realize that the people behind you there, in other words, you just go ahead and do what you were trained to do, and you do it automatically. You find a place that you could get in and land and try to get down in one piece is what's the biggest thing that you try to do on that type of thing.
And could you see the artillery and the ships below firing away at everything, or no?
Oh, yes. You can see the fighting on the ground. But we're only 500 feet, so you're not going to see very much. So we come in and land at a close, at about 500 foot is what we come in and land in. It wasn't like the Risley flew up high and cut loose and circled and come down. In other words, they pulled you in right close to where you're going to drop off.
Well, that seems to me like it would make it worse, because there's even less margin for error when you come in at 500 feet. So what did you see, and how did you know where to go and where to land? And were you scared at all? Because I'd be scared out of my mind.
Well, in other words, we were briefed about these fields being flooded with water. Of course, you knew it wouldn't be very deep. I could see a cut in the trees where there was an open deal and a little field beyond that. And if you were good at what you were doing, you was able to get into it. And we figured we'd get into it, and we did. All we did was knock the nose wheel off when we hit one little ditch across, because you couldn't tell from the air by a little ditching. But we knocked the nose wheel off, and otherwise it was landed right up where we're supposed to be. And everybody got off. There was a few of them sick, but...
Okay, so now you're coming in. You fly in over the beaches where all this fierce fighting is happening, and you're supposed to land behind enemy lines. You don't really have a way out of there other than your 2 feet. How do you know where you're going, and how do you think you're actually going to make it out of this alive? You know there's a war going on.
It depended on the guys that you had with us, in other words, the troopers, because they were more advanced than we just followed the boards. We were just a trooper then. After we got on the ground, we were just whatever maybe he was a first sergeant or somebody else. He says, in other words, like the band of brothers, you come on with me and you go, we'll get back to where we're supposed to go. We knew we was going to be the same as, at least we knew about where we were, but not exactly.
Did you have any idea? I mean, obviously your own life is in jeopardy here, but did you have any idea of what those paratroopers would be up against with the kind of fighting they were going to face?
No, I don't think any of us really knew what was going to be up against. It was one of those things that everything worked out good for me.
Was that landing? Were you anxious? Were you nervous?
No, I wasn't. Just like no different than flying in Indianapolis when I would come in and land in where I was supposed to be, or the first time when I ran out of gas. I had another one when I was in training, in other words, on ferry. In other words, the tow ship, the glider came loose from the tow ship. They didn't make a good connection with the tow ship. And I was over out of St. Louis in the Ozarks. Everybody and all the farmers in little towns in the woods in the Ozarks, they come looking. Here was an 85-foot airplane in our backyard. And it had been snowing, so there was probably about 3 or 4 foot of snow on the ground. But I flew a pattern there, and I seen a little hump in the snow, and I figured that was a fence, and sure enough it was. So I just got over it and sat down, and I dug in the snow, and I flew up to this guy's barn, landed right close to his barn. They took us in the house and fed us biscuits and bacon, and boy, really had a real good meal. And pretty soon the constable came, which is the law enforcement they had on the new Model A car, and he took us to the little bus stop. And I had a telephone there, and I called the base, and they said, oh, we already know that your tow ship circled you and said you were down okay. So, but the tow rope had come loose from the glider. We never did anything, so we just left it there, and the Army sent in a ground crew and picked it up.
Well, in the snow by St. Louis, they're waiting for you with bacon and biscuits. But on June 6th, when you put that thing down, was there concern that enemy forces might be nearby?
Oh, yes. We knew they were ground people because we'd seen them. The dead fellows already there where they had paratroopers that already had been fighting with them on our way to the CP. And we knew that they were being shot at every once in a while. So we was in a, we took the hedgerows, the roads along the hedgerows, and we'd be in the ditches. And we stayed in the ditches like that until when we were strung out maybe 10 to 15 feet apart, protecting each other, till we got to the CP. And then on the way back, when it was in that Jeep, in other words, we got come under sniper fire for a while, but we took care of the 17 of us, took care of him, and then we went on our way back to the beachhead.
And did you have any special instructions for what you were to do with the glider after you landed it?
Just leave it.
I know, I'm sure you've told these stories before, but you describe it so matter-of-factly, and it sure seems intimidating to me to land a glider behind enemy lines and have to work your way back, not knowing where the enemy is, to be shot at by snipers, all of this stuff that you've never experienced before, and you're just a young kid. What do you think it was that helped you get through that and helped you believe you could?
I don't know. It's just the way that, I suppose, the way that I was raised, in other words, and worked on. My dad was killed when I was 1930, so I was 8 years old in an automobile accident, a foggy morning at Hanford. And so I lived with my grandfather and my uncles, and they taught me all the things that I needed to know to survive.
They must have taught you pretty well. So you told us how you got back, but even when you get back to that beach and you're supposed to go out to this British ship, what did that beach look like? I mean, was there devastation everywhere?
We were strafed a couple of times. We had to dig into the sand because of the Germans they came and strafed the beach with fighter planes a couple of times, but they didn't last very long until our fighters took over, and that was it. They were still firing at that first on the 6th of June at night. That night, they were still fighting on the beachhead.
And you got to get off that beach. A landing craft took you to that British ship. But I imagine there are a lot of images from that 24-hour period you simply cannot erase from your memory. What'd you see from the deck of that ship?
I seen this big ship ahead of mine or something, and it was big. It was maybe 200 or 300 or 400 foot long. I mean, a big ship. I don't know whether it was a cruiser or what. But it just went up in the air, and then down I went. And you knew all these guys were on it. Never seen anybody get off of it. So, I mean, that was probably the worst thing that I'd seen as far as of all the other things that happened. And that was just before dark.
I can only imagine how difficult it must have been to see that and everything else you experienced on June 6, 1944. We can understand now why it's been famously dubbed the longest day. There were more close calls to come for glider pilot Morris Bennett. We'll hear about some of those when Hometown Heroes continues after more from our sponsors, starting with my good friends at Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it, they have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've heard how 89-year-old Morris Bennett of Woodlake flew gliders with the 94th Squadron of the 439th Troop Carrier Group. They earned a Presidential Unit Citation for their work on D-Day. He stayed behind in England while fellow glider pilots aided in the invasion of southern France a couple months later, and by September of 1944, the Allies were preparing a massive airborne and ground assault that would include over 2,000 gliders in addition to other air forces. It was called Operation Market Garden, and it was aimed at pushing German forces back through the Netherlands and across the Rhine River in the hopes of ending the war in Europe by Christmas. That's not exactly how it unfolded, and it would be another dangerous mission that Maurice Bennett was fortunate to survive.
They moved the group to Châteaudun in France, and I was our main base until the European war was over. The next mission then after that, when the combat mission we had, was Arnhem, Nijmegen, we had Grossbeck, and we had the 82nd Airborne is what we took in, and we didn't have enough pilots, so we didn't even have a co-pilot. And part of the equipment I had, there was a trailer with all the signal equipment, all the electronics for the communications for the whole group. So I had the trailer with that and the two people that worked with it. Some of them were shot down on the way in, but we knew it was going to be a rough mission. It was about 3 hours on tow, and we left somewhere around 7 in the morning. It was in September. We had May West, but I put an extra flak suit under my seat and went over my legs and went over my deal. And right after we hit the coast of the roads, and we were shot at by ground fire, barges on the bottom, and then we were shot at also by fighters. But the Spitfires came in and the P-51s came in, off defense boys, and they took those out and they took out the other deal. But I could see the tracers coming down there. You see them going through the side of the tow ship and come out on down the tow line. And then by that time they were going through ours. And that was probably the scariest mission that I had as far as wonder if I was even going to get on the ground. But after we got over the barges and got a little further inland, we was able to land. But I was picking up ground fire after I hit the CP. And we landed about 10:30 in the morning, and the paratroopers were dropping at the same time we dropped. Normally, the paratroopers come in ahead of us and clear the ground before we get in. But we were on the ground at the same time that they were. First Lieutenant ran over to me, and he says, I kind of cracked up a little bit. I mean, I had to get on the ground because I was being shot at pretty heavy.
And that glider, with what it's made out of, doesn't take fire very well.
And so I landed a little bit faster than I normally would land, and it was sandy, and I nosed over. So I just knocked the nose end of it off a little bit, but the load and everything else was on the ground in good shape. I landed right by an ammunition dump. There were all kinds of ammunition and guns and everything. There were stacks of them that the Germans had got together. And I says, I think I'm okay. In other words, of course, I was kind of dusty and dirty. Of course, you got probably 30 pounds of equipment, your helmet and all your other gear and the ammunition, and your legs are full of groceries for 3 or 4 days or whatever the case would be. You have everything on you that you don't have no chance of picking nothing up. You're all ready to go. So when you landed, you got out of there. We went over to this castle, and the German officers had just left it, having breakfast. Everything was still ham and eggs and everything just on the table when we landed. And so we stayed there that afternoon, and then that night they marched us downtown, and we took the bridge that crossed the Rhine, the 82nd Airborne. Mortar fire was hitting us pretty heavy. So they come over and said, in other words, well, you glider pilots, you are guards. You're going to be MPs. So I was an MP for 3 weeks with about 10 glider pilots, and we had over 3,000 prisoners. And we took an apple orchard that had a high deer fence around it. They couldn't come in and reinforce us or bring in any more troopers, and they tried to by air, but the weather was bad. And they made some pair of drops. So after pair of dropped it, they dropped in the German lines, and the Germans got them. And this was at Nijmegen, or the Arnhem, which is a bridge too far. There's a movie on the bridge too far. Well, this is where it was. And so about 3 weeks, we were relieved. They finally got through to us. The British came in and with the tanks and relieved us, and we went back. And I don't even remember how we ate. We didn't eat very much. In other words, I know that, because all we had was K rations with Cracker Jack boxes. But anyway, we got back on this Army 6x6, and then while I was sitting there, like we was sitting on benches on that thing, and one of the guys that was with us, in other words, he didn't unload his gun or did something, and it went off, and in the truck bed, but in other words, none of us was hurt. So
it's just in a growing list of close calls. That was part of Operation Market Garden, and before long, the Battle of the Bulge would come along.
Well, the next one was resupply on Bastogne, but what happened on that, I was ready to go. I was to take, it was on December 25th, and I was supposed to take off. The weather turned bad, and I really loaded, and all I had was ammunition to resupply. And went out the next morning. I didn't have to fly it because they brought in another somebody else because they said I'd already had flown enough missions.
So you were going to fly a glider into Bastogne in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge.
Right. And I was set to go on that, but in other words, I didn't fly it. So somebody else flew my glider, but it was wrecked, and the guy that flew it was killed. It was on the pilots that took it in the next day.
Well, I was about to imagine that fate for you if you would have flown it, and there's no mystery to it when you tell me that. How do you account for all of those situations where it should have been you and it wasn't?
I think the old boy up above is watching over me, and he had something more for me to do. That's the only thing that I've had, because I had too many of them that just wasn't done till they could have been 5 minutes or 10 minutes or an hour later. So then the next mission we had was crossing the Rhine at Wesel, which was only 50 miles on the river from where we dropped in September, or the ridge on the Grossbeck drop. But I had, I think, just troopers, and I flew a CG-4, and we flew a two gliders on the same tow ship. We came in across the Rhine River Valley, and broke out of the smoke about 200 feet, and all I had was an apple orchard ahead of us. Just landed down between the apple orchard and took the wings off, the outside wings. Came in pretty high and slipped and straightened out just before got where I was supposed to land. And of course, it took some real good flying there to do it. Flying by your seat of pants again. Landed, and we were right up against an 88. By this time, that the German army couldn't hit the airplanes at a low altitude. They had to be up pretty high before they could hit them. They didn't know how to set their guns to shoot at 500 feet. But they got to where they were, there the tail end, and we landed within maybe 50 feet of a German 88 gun emplacement. And my crew, my ground people, was able to take them over right then.
So the troopers you were carrying took out that 88. Otherwise, you would have been blown to smithereens.
That's right. In other words, that was it. And then the next morning, we stayed that night all night in foxholes, and we took parachutes that had been dropped and wrapped them around for to keep warm. And next morning we went back, and that was the end of my fighting.
But you would add C-47 navigator duties, and in that role fly resupply missions and also carry some pretty memorable passengers.
Well, C-47, I think we'd haul 15 or 20 people normally. In other words, we'd have 40 or 50 of these prisoners that we took out of those concentration camps. And we have a nurse on board, and we had to be deloused, in other words, because everybody had lice.
To see the shape that those prisoners were in, what was that like emotionally, just to see people?
That was probably the worst thing that of everything that I can remember, in other words. I mean, that's why I support the service and the people there, because, in other words, unless you see it, people can't believe how the shape that those prisoners was in.
What did they look like?
If a person that would weigh 180 to 200 pounds, weigh 85 or 90 pounds, it'd be like going to a rest home where all the people had cancer, and you could smell it when you walk in. In other words, and you could smell them when you even before you got there.
These weren't American prisoners of war. These were people that had been in the concentration camps?
They were both. We called a lot of the prisoners of war, or our prisoners of war, back, and the people that were in concentration camps, both ways. And most of our soldiers weren't, or airmen that was there, they weren't dilapidated or, you know, like the concentration camp people were. The concentration camp people were in really bad shape.
And at that time, had you been aware at all of what was happening in those concentration camps, or was this just a complete shock to your system that people could be in this kind of condition?
No, I had no idea. I don't think anybody would. I don't think anybody would realize it even now, unless you were there, shape that they'd be in.
And when you see something like that, I mean, obviously everything that you've been through is pretty incredible. When you see something like that, does that make it seem more important to you to talk about it, to make sure people know about what happened in World War II?
Well, for 40 years, 35 or 40 years, I didn't even mention my overseas time, because I guess most of us kept Kel pretty well in herself, even when we got together.
You're one of the last ones left. There weren't very many glider pilots to begin with.
There's about roughly 5,000 glider pilots trained to start with.
How many do you think are still around?
Probably 1,500, maybe, in thereabouts. There's only two in the valley that I know of.
What would you say you're most proud of?
Being able to do the job that I did, I guess, without getting hurt.
What was it like to come home when the war was over and you were done?
They flew us back in B-24s. I had a buddy, and a lot of us was able to even, there was only two or three of us in a B-24, but in other words, they flew back, and some of them went and had a buddy, Bob Baker. He was in another one, and they said, off to our wing. In other words, they developed trouble, and they went in after going through all the deals that we both of us have went through together, in other words, and flown together. According to the reunions and everything, that he was killed in on the Vasa mission when we were down. But I know when he went down on the way back.
Another it could have just as easily been you moment. You got back to the States, thought for sure you'd be flying gliders in an impending invasion of Japan. But while you had a short leave, you had to make sure to see your wife, who'd been waiting patiently and praying for you back home in California.
I picked up my wife and we went to...
Don't gloss over that. You hadn't seen your wife in how long?
3.5 years.
And I'm sure there are days you didn't think you were going to see her again, right?
No, I always figured I was going to make it. She used to tell me, in other words, a few years past, before she passed away 10 years ago, she said, you think you're going to live forever. In other words, I know I'm not. But that's what she always said, that you think you're going to go forever. But we went to Cambria Pines when she had an uncle over there that had retired from the service several years before. So we went over the coast and spent a couple of days there. And during that time, they dropped the bomb on Japan, and the war was over. And I would report back to San Diego. I got a separation from active duty, but never no discharge. I'm still separated from active duty.
So when you think about the fact that you're... children would have never been born, your grandchildren and great-grandchildren would have never been born if you hadn't survived all those situations where it could have been you. What does that make you thankful for now?
I don't know. You don't really think too much about it, really, but I think we got a pretty good country up to the right to present time. We're in a bad shape, but maybe we'll get it straightened around.
And for people that weren't alive then, what do you want them to know about the guys that you served with? What all those brave men and women did 70 years ago. What do you think we need to remember about that time in our history?
Well, I think we should remember that some people don't believe in God, but in other words, I do. I believe that he had his hand in watching over what I was supposed to be doing. And so I think, in other words, I think we still need God in our country and behind our deal. I don't think this idea of taking over and going to a socialist type of country and letting the government run everything. I think the people should run the country as what we did back when I was a kid.
Well, I just want to say on behalf of our listeners, thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us some of those stories. If we park a CG-4 at the airfield down the road, you going to climb in behind the wheel?
Yeah, I could.
I had a feeling you'd say that. Morris Bennett, 89 years old. Drop in at Woodlake Hardware one of these days and say hello to him. And join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
Another thing, that's what happened on that. And I had a lot of other emergency landings and so forth besides what I did there. But back when I was in prime and basic or advanced, the CO of the group came out with in a Jeep, and they said, we was just student pilots. There was three or four of us, and getting ready to take off. And they said, everybody get back, step back one glider back to the back, because we want to show these people in news and the Army brass. In other words, take a glider ride. So everybody moved back then, and so in other words, I don't remember who the pilot was on the first glider, but in other words, we came back, and the glider that I was in, it lost the wing when it went ahead and took off. In other words, it lost the wing at the end of the runway. So it wasn't my time. My time was to still go further.
So if you hadn't been bumped back, you would have been in a glider that lost its wing and crashed.
And then about the same time they had lost the wing in St. Louis with the people. There was, they were showing them what the news people, what the glider did, but they killed the people that rode in the glider, in other words, on the one in St. Louis. And this the one that went here was just the two student pilots, because the sightseers were already in the one that was that they were already in. But that's just one of the things that I was able to come through in on.
Well, and it kind of reminds you of how dangerous what you're doing is, huh?
That's right. You never know. Because all them things came together with just about a three-quarter bolt when the wings came down and put it to the just above the wheels. When they first started with the combat gliders, they didn't have wheels on them. But in other words, they decided to put wheels on them. And they first just landed on a skid, but they couldn't control it on the ground. In other words, if you got on the ground, you could roll them around with the wheels, and you could put some brakes on it and do things like that. That I had to go through, in other words, even if they'd been flying for a long time. And being I was young and coordinated right, because you had to take eye test and depth perception and all them kind of things. They would line up little deals, like I go to the eye doctor now, and I said, I don't think I could do that to what I used to do.
Well, you shouldn't be able to at almost 90, but you don't seem like your average 89-year-old either. When was the first time that you actually got to sit in and practice in an actual glider like the ones you'd be flying for real?
Well, from after we graduated from Hayes, Kansas, we went back to Randolph Field, Texas, for another pool again. We sat there for a while, and they didn't know where to put us because they was graduating too many people from different places, and they didn't. The next step was what we call the basic training. In some places, some fields, I think, even in Victorville, they used sailplanes, which was, I don't remember the name of them. Swyster was one of them, and they had another one. And they split us up, and so I happened to go to Greenville, South Carolina, which was my basic training. And some of the fellas I was with, they went to Mobile, Alabama, and that was basic training. But what they did there, they took the motors out of the Ronicas and the Taylor craft and the Cubs, and they didn't have motors. Most of them was the Ronicas what they used there, and they had some sailplanes, but most of the time they didn't have a sailplane, enough of them to do it. So then they pulled us up with AT-5s or 6s, in other words, the advanced training for the fighter pilots and bomber pilots. And they towed us with them, and we went up from up to 5,000 feet, and that's where we did maneuvers without any. They'd cut us loose, and we'd have to spin and do all the kind of things like that, and then get back to close to the base again when they cut you loose, and then you'd be able to base your wind and so forth, be able to land where you're supposed to. Some people wasn't able to do that, so they get washed out. But you had to play with the wind and all the other things to make sure you stayed with the program. And that was about a 35 or 40 hours in the air, besides all the ground school work. The ground school work, they washed out on ground school the same as what you did on flying, of meteorology and aircraft identification. And so you was trained the same as what a power pilot was, practically.
Did it ever seem like dangerous work to you?
Not really. Not really. In other words, it was everything worked out in pretty good shape, and most of that deal. So then from some of them, a fellow by the name of Gene Stokes, which had passed away a few years ago from Visalia, he and I went in together. But Gene used to get sick, air sick, and I think because he was a little bit afraid occasionally. And so he'd get air sick, and he'd come back down, so they washed him out. He came home right then. This was in December of 43. And then we would report to Louisville, Kentucky from Randolph Field, or from Lubbock, and take big guns, go out every morning to the artillery deal and fire big guns. But we never, I only did one week for that is all I did. Meantime, all the time he was still going through school, you was still took ground training and took guns apart and did all this, and you went through rifle range and all everything the Army did, any too. So we were trained in ground warfare along with aerial warfare. So we went to, I got to Louisville, and about a week, 10 days there, they called me up and told me to report to headquarters in Indianapolis, which is a troop carrier. And I got the troop there, and they said, well, your record show that you can be a ferry pilot. So we'd go to the factories and pick up the gliders, which had never been flown, from manufactured, and fly them to the army, different air bases where we had, like Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and back to Lubbock. We'd fly the gliders into there. And I did that for, there was about 20 of us that did this. And we'd have to come back to headquarters, and every time we come back to Stout Field, which was Indianapolis, in other words, they had all the generals out there, and they'd have us make sure that we had landed in a certain area. They had a spot, and to show them how good that we were, that we could come in and cut loose and be able to land right where they wanted us to. So we did this. So we ended up being trying. And I went out one morning, and they said, you report tomorrow, back here at 8 o'clock. A lot of times we go to work at 6 in the morning. And go back here at 8 o'clock, and you're going to Louisville, and then you're going to Fort Bragg to take some special training. I went up to my brother-in-law was in the Air Force. He was a sergeant, and he'd been in England for about 6 months, and so I went up to his base, and he was on duty, and this was at night, so I went in and pulled my clothes off and crawled in. I found out where his bunk was and went to his bed, and the next morning he came in, and from night duty, he was on B-17 base, and I don't know what he did, but anyway, he's in my bed, in other words, and he's seen my officer's uniform laying on his bunk, and I said, in other words, I thought maybe we could get 2 or 3 days off and you could take me where he's supposed to go rest in England. And he said, I don't know if I can do that or not. And I said, well, let's go see your CO. So we went down to see his CO. He says, you just got back from Normandy. In other words, you can take your sergeant and go wherever you want to with him. So he gave him a 72-hour pass, and we went to Manchester, and he showed me the town of Manchester, which I'd never been to, but he'd been there a couple of times and had met a few people, local people, so had to travel in a boxcar like they'd haul cattle in or something like that, but that's the kind of people, the transportation they didn't have. Most of the trains in England were all full of deal, but I know you just stood up in the deal. He stood there, and that's when it was. I forget how many miles it was. It was only maybe an hour's ride from where we were to. It's like going from here from Fresno to Stockton or something like that.